Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit is unumstossbar.
Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago. He's fired!
Au nom du peuple français!
Wir schaffen das.
Make our planet great again.
Don't worry, be happy.
I will kill you if you destroy my country.
Better is always possible.
Let's do this!
I ain't spending any time on it.
Hello, I'm Brett Mason, in the gallery for SBS World News. This week, Malcolm Turnbull fires up, facing questions about the human rights records of his VIP guests at the ASEAN Australia Special Summit in Sydney.
If you don't publicly raise Australia's strong objections, aren't you tacitly approving of their crimes?
You've made some sweeping generalisations there.
Our exclusive interview with Vietnam's Deputy Prime Minister Pham Binh Minh.
The convening of this special summit, the first ever between ASEAN and Australia, is the demonstrations of the wish, visions of both ASEAN and Australia for deepening and broadening the relationship between ASEAN and Australia.
Plus, we're live to London to find out why a leading Brexiteer was left floundering on the River Thames.
I'm concerned that we'll get absolutely stuffed again on the quota deal. Mind you, look at these. These are haddocks, all right? Great, my favourite eating fish.
SBS Europe correspondent Ben Lewis will mull it over in a moment. But first, here's our political reporter Miles Morgan with a look back at the week that was.
Thanks, Brett. And in the last week, as well as that meeting of world leaders, we saw two elections and accusations of pickpocketing in politics. We started with a political Super Saturday, which saw voters in the Melbourne seat of Batman choose a new Labor MP to represent them in federal parliament. And the state of South Australia elected a new Liberal government. See, the thing about state elections is federal governments don't want anything to do with them if their state party counterparts don't win. But when the Liberals ended 16 years of Labor rule in South Australia, Malcolm Turnbull said it was a strong endorsement of the coalition's energy policy.
The people have spoken, and they have spoken in favour of our policies which support affordable and reliable energy, which will ensure we can meet our Paris commitments and at the same time ensure that we can keep the lights on.
Labor leader Bill Shorten didn't commiserate for too long because he was celebrating with Jed Carney, who won the Batman by-election.
Guess what, everybody? I'm on my way to Canberra. And Labor is on its way to a Shorten government.
But the Prime Minister says the win isn't a reflection of Bill Shorten's popularity because Labor's held the seat since 1969. Chalking up one election win each, both parties went into the week with dueling tax policies. Labor's indicating it may soften its proposal to abolish cash refunds on franked credits, which is expected to affect about 200,000 pensioners. But that didn't stop Malcolm Turnbull escalating the hyperbole.
It's a disgrace, and no wonder Australians right around the country are horrified by his cynical effort to pick their pockets to go after the savings of our older Australians.
Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen wasn't having any of it.
Scaring Australia's pensioners, with 90% unaffected by Labor's changes, scaring Australia's pensioners is an irresponsible thing to do. Stop lying, Mr. Turnbull, and start leading.
As the coalition attacked what it's calling Labor's retiree tax, it tried to push its own company tax cuts through the Senate. One of the government's signature budget policies is to cut Australia's corporate tax rate to 25% for all businesses by 2026. The government's a few votes away from passing its legislation, but it needs the support of a few more crossbenchers. The Greens leader, Richard Di Natale, isn't on board. Here's why.
There is no evidence, not in the States, not anywhere in the world, that a company tax cut delivers sustained wage growth. 40% or so of the benefit will flow overseas. It won't even benefit Australians. So this is a bad policy.
The nation's capital also welcomed some foreign dignitaries, among them the de facto leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi. She came to Canberra for private meetings with Malcolm Turnbull and with the opposition leader. The Nobel Peace Prize winner's Australian tour has been the subject of protests and fierce criticism because of her government's policies in Myanmar. 700,000 Rohingya refugees have fled the nation's Rakhine state to escape a military crackdown, which the United Nations says has all the hallmarks of genocide. She was also due to give a speech in Sydney, which would have undoubtedly drawn more protests. But she cancelled her only public speaking event, telling organisers she wasn't feeling well.
The ASEAN-Australia Special Summit wrapped up in Sydney on Sunday afternoon, with the 11 leaders signing off on the so-called Sydney Declaration. While the 2,000-word document set out a reciprocal commitment to developing closer ties, it failed to address some of the big issues facing the association, particularly the Rohingya crisis, and agreeing the terms of a legally binding code of conduct to resolve the ongoing disputes in the South China Sea. Human rights activists protested outside the venue in Darling Harbour, and despite threats from Cambodia's leader to beat protesters who dared to burn his effigy, they did. Here's what I asked the Prime Minister as the summit began.
You're hosting leaders whose regimes have jailed political opponents and journalists. They've threatened to beat protesters on the streets of Sydney. They've encouraged state-sanctioned killings without trial, and they've driven more than 700,000 Rohingya from their homes. What will you say to those leaders? And if you don't publicly raise Australia's strong objections, aren't you tacitly approving of their crimes?
The engagement that we have in our region is a frank frank engagement with all of the countries in the region, and you've made some sweeping generalisations there. I just want to say that we approach ASEAN with the greatest of respect. We respect the centrality of ASEAN in our region. We respect the consensus model upon which it's based, and we will be discussing issues of every description, economic, strategic, human rights. You mentioned issues relating to the Rakhine State in Myanmar. Obviously, I'll be discussing those with the State Councillor when I meet her shortly.
The Sydney summit was of particular significance to Vietnam, which has now upgraded diplomatic, trade, defence and economic ties with Australia to a formal strategic partnership. I sat down with Vietnam's Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Pham Binh Minh to find out exactly what that strategic partnership means.
It means that we can develop the relations in all fields, from politics, economics, to defense, security, and people-to-people exchange. Australia now is the country's destinations for education for the youngsters in Vietnam. In 2017, we have about 30,000 Vietnamese students studying in Australia. I believe that the number will be increased in the year ahead.
What does Vietnam see as the big opportunities for ASEAN, and what do you see as the biggest threats?
You know, ASEAN and Australia are important to each other. We appreciate Australia's respect for the centrality of ASEAN. And the convening of this special summit, the first ever between ASEAN and Australia, is the demonstrations of the wish, visions of both ASEAN and Australia for deepening and broadening the relationship between ASEAN and Australia. ASEAN is a big market for Australia, more than 650 million of people living in ASEAN. So this is a big market for Australia. Australia respects ASEAN's centrality, solidarity, and also we share the views that we need to build the regions of peace, prosperity, stability, And with regard to the maritime security, for example, ASEAN and Australia share the same interests, strategic interests.
On that point, Vietnam has been very vocal in its concerns about what's been taking place in the South China Sea. Has ASEAN been strong enough in its condemnation of China's conduct? Is the language out of this summit as strong as Vietnam would like? And Donald Trump, the US President, and Malcolm Turnbull, the Australian Prime Minister, have been talking about stepping up freedom of navigation activities in the South China Sea. Would you welcome that?
I can say that Vietnam is not a vocal one. That is the positions of ASEAN on the maritime security and also on the South China Sea. This South China Sea is the very important lane. And all countries, even within the regions or outside the region, need the freedom of navigations, need the safety, needs stability in the region. And that is the duty of all countries, not only the countries concerned, but also the other countries outside. So we very much appreciate that all countries uphold the principles of international law, the law of the sea. And we have already approved the framework of the code of conduct. That is not enough. We need a legal binding COC. That means that we all know that if we do not have any legal documents to prevent any further, any future conflicts or any escalations of tensions in the region, this is not our concern. It is not our only concern. This is also the concerns of the ASEAN countries, because anything happen in the South China Sea, it will affect not only the claimant state, but also affects the stability and prosperity in the region. And it affects all ASEAN countries, and it affects also the country, the dialogue partners or the countries of surrounding. So this is not our own concern, but it's the concerns of the region.
There has been some welcome news between the United States and North Korea, with talk that Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump may meet, and there has been some speculation that that meeting might take place in your country. Would Vietnam be willing to host such talks?
You know, as we welcome all the reconciliations between the two countries, because we always desire peace and stability in the Korean Peninsula. And any steps towards that situations, we welcome. So we welcome the direct talks between the North Korean leaders and United States leader. And surely that if they choose Hanoi or any place in Vietnam, we welcome. We welcome, because we have the relations with both countries, with the United States, with Korea, North Korea. So this is the welcome development in the region.
One of my absolute favourite stories from my 8 years reporting from London happened just a few days before the Brexit vote in June 2016. A flotilla of fishing trawlers was making its way down the River Thames to protest EU fishing quotas outside the Houses of Parliament. We reported live from one of those vessels. Let's take a listen.
Brett Mason is on board one of those trawlers and he joins us now live. Brett.
Well, Janice, this is the head of the flotilla. The Atlantic Challenge has come all the way from Scotland. There are vessels here too from Northern Ireland to show their support for the Leave campaign. They will circle outside the Houses of Parliament and sound their horns in protest.
How great is this that we've an armada of boats to come and say, this is our country, this is what we fought for continuously. I mean, as Winston Churchill said, this is our island and we should defend it, whatever the cost may be. And we should be proud. We've got Australia, Canada, New Zealand. That's our family, not Europe.
Now, at that point, we had no idea that there was a rival flotilla waiting at Tower Bridge to ambush the Brexiteers. They were led by Sir Bob Geldof, and here's what he shouted from his vessel at Nigel Farage on a rival boat.
Nigel, stop telling lies. Britain makes more money from fishing than any other EU country.
You're a fraud, Nigel. Go back down the river because you're up one without a canoe or a paddle.
Well, fast forward 2 years, and as SBS Europe correspondent Ben Lewis tells us, history has repeated itself.
Brett, absolutely bizarre scenes. Now, you might remember before the actual referendum vote, we had Nigel Farage floating on a flotilla of boats down the Thames with fishing protesters getting squirted with fire hoses by Bob Geldof from the Remain campaign. This time, it was Nigel Farage back on a boat again, and he was tipping a bunch of perfectly good dead fish into the Thames. Now, it was part of a protest about fishing rights after Britain leaves the EU. A lot of fishermen in the UK are angry because as part of this transition deal, which has been hammered out, fishermen from the, and fishermen, of course, from EU nations will still be able to access much of the UK's territorial fishing waters. And of course, one of the big things about the whole Leave campaign in the first place was taking back control. And this fishing situation has sort of become a little bit of a point of contention, particularly amongst people who say that Theresa May's government simply is giving in too much to the EU and that they're not taking back control after all. Now, poor old Jacob Rees-Mogg, the Conservative MP, who's a bit of a favourite with the Leave crowd, he, Mogmentum indeed, he tried to take part in the flotilla, but then he went down to the jetty and it turned out that the boat didn't have the correct licence to get there, so he wasn't allowed on. So the boat was doing circles in the middle of the Thames, dumping fish, the whole thing a little bit chaotic.
We should say it was actually British legislation that prevented that boat from docking, not EU legislation, which is a rather ironic sight. How was Jacob Rees-Mogg dressed? Was he suitably attired for a day on the Thames?
Absolutely not. Of course he wasn't. He was wearing the full three-piece suit with the jacket and the thick glasses. And he did see the humour, I think, of a boat aimlessly circling around the middle of the Thames, trying to make a political point without a clear destination. But he did get a bit of a joke out of it, a bit of a laugh out of it. But Nigel Farage, once again the star of the show, despite the fact that he's no longer the leader of UKIP and is now really just a very loud private citizen.
I'm concerned that we'll get absolutely stuffed again on the quota deal. Mind you, look at these.
Is this godfish down there?
Right. These are haddocks, all right? Great, my favourite eating fish. Lovely fish, stocks are plentiful in the West Country, and yet, of the total allocation for haddock around the European Union, guess how much we get? 9%. 9%. And so you can't avoid catching them, and so this stuff gets thrown back dead. I mean, the whole thing is mad.
It seems crazy.
There is an analogy somewhere in there about a rudderless ship doing laps of the Thames, throwing dead fish overboard. We had some news out of Brussels this week, too, in terms of the final Brexit deal. David Davis, the British Brexit Secretary, has been going back and forth, and the last few meetings didn't seem to make too much progress. But this time around, we hear about 75% of the key Brexit guidelines have been agreed.
Yeah, that's right. And they held quite an extraordinary press conference, David Davis and Michel Barnier, where they put the agreement up behind them on a big screen and showed the green highlighted areas where there is agreement. As you said, it's about 75%, which means that at the European Council meeting that's coming up, it's likely that the transition period deal, which will run until the end of 2020, is going to be signed off, sealed, delivered. Everyone on both sides assumes that is going to get through okay, but they've only reached that stage by kicking some key issues down the road. And, of course, the big one is what to do about the Irish border. The UK is not entirely keen on Europe's insistence that they have this backstop option, which essentially means that if no other compromise or deal can be reached, that Northern Ireland will essentially remain within the European Customs Union and to some degree, the single market. Now, of course, that's a problem with the UK government because Theresa May needs the DUP of Northern Ireland to keep her government together. The DUP doesn't want Northern Ireland to be treated any differently to Great Britain. So it's a little bit of a difficult situation to see how they're going to get around it. And as has been the case quite a lot during these Brexit negotiations, it seems it's being dealt with by just punting it further down the road. But at some time, both sides are going to have to confront this issue head on and work out what on earth they're going to do about it.
And what are the so-called Ramonas saying about all of this? What's the mood like as these negotiations drag on and on and on, and that Brexit cliff edge we've heard so much about gets closer and closer?
I think the overwhelming view from people around Westminster at the moment, both Remainers and people who supported the Leave campaign to some degree, is thank goodness that some sort of progress has been made. I mean, we had weeks where we had Conservative ministers giving speeches about the roadmap to Brexit. We had the tough talk from Jean-Claude Juncker and from Michel Barnier talking about clocks ticking, time is running out. So finally, something seems to have been agreed upon. The concern by some on the Leave side, however, is that perhaps Britain has given away a little bit more than they really needed to. I mean, the fishery rules, one key example of that. Remainers will be relatively happy. Of course, a lot of people were still hoping that the UK would stay in the customs union and the single market. Theresa May has said that is absolutely not going to happen. But from the sounds of things, that there will be some sort of regulatory alignment, which might be enough to keep a Philip Hammond in cabinet happy, although whether it's enough to keep the Jacob Rees-Mogg's happy, the deal that has been signed, remains to be seen. I doubt it.
And what's Boris Johnson saying? Perhaps the most important question of all.
Of course, Boris has been pretty vocal throughout this entire negotiating period, but for the last couple of weeks he's had to deal with an area that's actually within his own portfolio, within cabinet, dealing with the Sergei Skripal attempted assassination and the fallout with Russia. He says he's backing Theresa May and her strategy, the way that this is all going. He hasn't had a huge amount to say about the transition period deal, other than that it's good that progress is being made. The thought around Westminster is perhaps he's just laying low for a little while, being quiet. He was criticised for sticking his nose where it didn't belong recently, so perhaps he's waiting to see how Theresa May plays this one out. She's managed to escape being in a lot more trouble a few times recently, and so perhaps he's waiting to see if she stumbles when it starts getting to the trickier business that still needs to be negotiated with the EU.
Ben Lewis in London, thank you very much for your Brexit update, and hopefully the weather was nice for your day out on the Thames.
It was sunny but cold, which is how it's going to be for the next 3 months, I'm entirely sure.
Just how we like our weather in Canberra.
SBS acknowledges the Ngunnawal people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which the Australian Parliament sits and where this program was recorded. We pay respect to the elders of the Ngunnawal Nation, both past and present.